spirituality from a number of different vantage points each Sunday morning. And let's start this morning's presentation and consideration with a brief reading from The Light on the Path. You can find this in the first couple of pages. And we're just going to go through the first four major points. Light on the Path, Part 1. These rules are written for all disciples. Attend you to them. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. Before the soul can stand in the presence of the masters, its feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. And then follows four initial rules. Number one, kill out ambition. Two, kill out desire of life. Three, kill out desire of comfort. Four, work as those work who are ambitious. Respect life as those do who desire it. Be happy as those are who live for happiness. Seek in the heart the source of evil and expunge it. It lives fruitfully in the heart of the devoted disciple, as well as in the heart of the man of desire. Only the strong can kill it out. The weak must wait for its growth, its fruition, its death. And it is a plant that lives and increases throughout the ages. It flowers when the man has accumulated unto himself innumerable experiences. He who will enter upon the path of power must tear this thing out of his heart. And then the heart will bleed, and the whole life of the man seemed to be utterly dissolved. This ordeal must be endured. It may come at the first step of the perilous ladder which leads to the path of life. It may not come until the last. But, O disciple, remember that it has to be endured and fasten the energies of your soul upon the task. Live neither in the present nor the future, but in the eternal. This giant weed cannot flower there. This blot upon existence is wiped out by the very atmosphere of eternal thought. And again, those are the opening lines of Light on the Path. So, where have we been for a month? And where are we going to go this morning? Well, this is the capstone title for the month. And in review, if you take a minute to consider, you will recall that the entire month has been constructed to move from universal considerations to particular considerations in an exploration of psychism and spirituality. We started out the first few Sunday sessions with considerations of more universal, perhaps more abstract or theoretical points of view. What is the source of this eternal that we heard about in The Light on the Path? What source of power is that in the human state of incarnation? We considered the power of imagination used from psychic levels or spiritual levels. We considered the exemplar of genius, full genius of the Mahatma or perfected soul, partial genius in the more mundane realm of earthly existence. And then we turn to a more pragmatic, perhaps more particularized application of psychism and spirituality. Last week, we considered what it is to lead the spiritual life, universal, but practical in that consideration. And this morning, we get a little more focused, a little more pragmatic, a little more tangible, perhaps, in considering ambition versus aspiration. So we're using a case study of our own experience of incarnation, but in the context of the Americas as an incarnation of the collective during the Kali Yuga. And we're considering this particular notion of ambition versus aspiration. Well, let's consider it from the source first, and echo that transition from universal to particular. We've read over and over again through the years that, quote, desire first arose in it, that there is this alpha and omega force that comes forth from the absolute and manifests. When we read Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, we get to a point where we're reading about the thirst for life that there is within each human constitution, this tanha, this particular application of this desire. So we have this spiritual desire that is from the absolute, that is colorless, that is a tremendous force of energy and vibration. And then we read in other sources about how that is transmuted into the lower physical incarnations that each of us experience. And desire filtered through the human state is like white light filtered through the prism. What emerges is manifestations, an array, if you will, of the spiritualized force of aspiration and the personified force of ambition. Now, are we playing semantics? Well, if you look the words up, it is a matter of nuance. We see a spectrum, a continuum of this notion of desire manifesting as ambition and aspiration. But ambition is considered to be, in our parlance in English, a strong desire to do or to achieve, a very determined endeavor of hard work to achieve success. Whereas when we look up the word aspiration, there's a more ethereal concept to that, that it is a hope or an ambition of achieving something. There's a degree of imaginative, idealistic aspirations, a dream that's being held as a focus for that force of ambition. And so we have to wonder, and we may want to visit this during the Q&A session, is the title Ambition versus Aspiration, is that what this is all about? Or indeed, is there a spectrum of mindfulness that we can use intuition from within the heart and soul and then express that without? So can we have a noetic spiritual action that is expressed in the psychic lower nature? Is this really a competition between these two concepts of ambition and aspiration? Are they polar opposites, or is it something else? Well, we share an incarnation, like it or not, in a collective environment that is part of the Kali Yuga. And karmically, we have reincarnated as soul into the context. Most of us here are in the Americas this morning. And so when you consider the Americas from about 1600 to 2026, and keep in mind the Kali Yuga and the forces that are going on there, we know we swim in an ocean of astral psychic influences that have preceded us, but we've been magnetically drawn into this by karma. There's the American dream held by those immigrants to this continent that were voluntary immigrants, not those humans that were brought here as slaves or indentured servants. Among the voluntary immigrants, there was an appetite, a series of appetites of ambitions. And we've all read in history classes about streets paved with gold and how that overarching motivation has helped to develop the fabric of our society. We know too that in the Americas, the gospel of wealth that goes back for decades, if not centuries, and currently has an embodiment among lay-led Christian congregations. That gospel of wealth, a lower reflection of Calvinism perhaps, says that if you achieve great financial success in this particular life, then you are chosen by the deific essence, the Lord. And therefore, your blessings are a reflection of soulful prowess. Manifest destiny, in the broader statement of American history, is a reflection of this in a certain way also. Individuals that were raised in the early 1900s were reading, if they could afford a book, if they knew how to read, they were reading a series of little novels, basically for young white boys, written by Horatio Alger, the Rags to Riches series of little books, Mark the Match Boy. There's a whole set of titles. This has colored our political scene and our societal thinking ever since, that it's possible for a graced, pure-hearted, talented youngster with great industriousness to attract a benefactor who's going to raise him up in social standings and possibilities. And therefore, the child can move from being homeless, an orphan on the street, to being a tremendously successful human being. If you go back through the politics of the late 1900s, even until today, that particular rags to riches stories is often used as a theme in a biography for those that are running for political office. And so we've got this, even in our education classroom, the contrast between competitive academic contests and cooperative learning talents, two very different themes going on, again, part of the Kali Yuga, and something that we have to be aware of because we move through this astral or psychic scene of all these impresses. From 1875 on, those of us that have rediscovered theosophy and the theosophical movement get a chance, an opportunity to look at this context and look at our own incarnations in new light on the subject. We do see the unity that contrasts with individual salvation, the separateness of competitiveness, dog-eat-dog world where ambition is a driving force. As students, we are examining karma and reincarnation in light of being an unlimited opportunity to study and fit ourselves to serve the divine plan for harmony, oneness, universality, spirituality, far superior to finite psychism and personality. And as students, we're aware of a self-devised, self-fulfilled effort, endeavor, to evolve into something far more spiritual, far more powerful in soul powers, and far, far more capable in coloring the environment and the uplift for all manifestation. And so students often work very hard to be aware of the context in which they live, to be aware and discerning of returning impresses that are magnetized, attracted back to their soul as soul, and begin to evolve themselves to purify motive, to take the awareness and transmute it into something that is far more powerful for the best and the good of all. We hear that often. It's raise the self by the self. We see it in articles like Blavatsky's Psychic and Noetic Action. And we certainly heard about it last Sunday. So, in 2026, our task is a self-study of an examined life within the conditions that are at hand for us as soul. True asceticism is detachment, it's discrimination or discernment, it's determination to focus, to identify the power of desire and to focus it, to create it as a positive force for universal welfare, universal evolution. It's a 24/7 meditative stance of self-examination, trying to be aware in the moment and to do the best or the better rather than the dearer. It is a focus that can be sandwiched literally between a morning period of meditation and an evening period of review meditation. And in this process, that student that would become the path for others, that student whose soul is struggling to express this, becomes aware of all returning cycles of past impress and use of the desire force, the karmic nature. In any moment, we have the opportunity as thinkers, as heartfelt thinkers, to consider if I have a rising impulse, I sense in this personality, in this physical frame, what I think is ambition, or maybe that's an aspiration, a hope, a lofty desire. How do I act on this? And in the moment, we can count to 10 and figure what's the better course of action. Is this an illusion that's masking a mixed motive of something that's dearer? Am I automatically expressing the societal or collective psychic impulse? In this activity of this moment by moment metacognition, can we discern the bright line? The bright line between do no harm to others, uplift others, and do what really feels good for I, me, my. Can we discern the two and make the better choice? And again, we're cognizant as students that this is actually a returning opportunity from past lives, from earlier in this life, an amalgam of both. And we also have the opportunity as thinkers, as dynamos, as generators of spiritual force, we can create a new habituation, a new set of habits of thought, habits of response, not knee-jerk reactions. We can develop that habituation into a full bloom of automaticity where we're intuitively responding to circumstances, direct cognition. We have an insight, we know how to respond, we know how to uplift. And how do we begin to do that? Well, we could create for ourselves an anchor that celebrates the ideal aspiration of universal brotherhood. We could develop some sort of trigger statement that might come to mind if we're thinking, whew, that was a selfish point of view. or I think this is a selfish ambition or desire. We could substitute an anchor statement about the true nature of self and how to use the true nature of self in order to uplift all. It might be something that we've read from Light on the Path or Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. It might be a little tiny phrase or word from the Gita or the Voice of the Silence. But we can color each day using spiritual force, a spiritualized notion of kama, desire, appropriate to the conditions that we encounter, empowering rather than enabling our use of lower mind and others' use of lower mind. And as we endure circumstances, as was said in the reading this morning, as we begin to radiate a new level of thought and use of desire, we might even be able to take a finite ambition, recognize it, and then transmute it and uplift it into a more universal application. And in that way, we're aspiring and we're transmitting that into the collective, creating a namaste moment for ourselves and others. No moment is too mundane. Every moment is an opportunity to plant seeds and to nurture those spiritual seeds. If only we're focused and actively alert on recognizing and realizing, is this a need? Is it a basic need? Or is this a want, a luxury? Is this me-centered? Or is this thought and this impulse I-centered? Is this a passive feeling that we've got that we're reacting to? Or is this an active, creative generation of a hope and aspiration? We are, as soul, eternal pilgrims spiraling through incarnations. We are eternal stewards, shepherds, servants of the wellness and the well-being of all manifestation. If we can gain psychophysiological control over those lower aspects or instruments that we use as soul, then we're developing a sense and a habit of pure asceticism. We're using desire from an ambition that might be focused and personal and lifting it to something that is far more spiritual and far more universal, noetic. But we need to understand the lower within us so that we can have compassion as we see that lower in others around us. It takes gentle, patient endurance, self-education. It takes the purifying of mind and heart, purifying ambitions, which are natural drives. We do want to survive in this world, but for what reason? What's the motive? So the goal is to become the path, to experience, to educate ourselves so that we can better educate others, to envision and therefore energize the collective astral or psychal realm with a vision of soul powers universally used for divine brotherhood of all beings, human and in all states. We can use this experience and self-education and envisioning to elevate and ultimately to emancipate soul from all conditions that are limiting. And in order to do this, to use what the Gita calls the gunas and to rise above them, we need our little spiritual books as accompaniment, as inspiration. We need to recognize that desire is natural. It's a universal force. Every single self-conscious entity realizes it. But we can begin to train ourselves to think with the heart. The electrical system in the physical heart affects the physical brain. And that's only a shadow example of what goes on in the spiritual realms as well. It's not money that's the root of all evil in our culture. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil. We all need food and lodging from cradle to grave. We all need human services from cradle to grave. Wouldn't it be lovely if we could envision a society where all souls are given an equal and equitable advantage to a starting block? Were empowered with all of their human needs met, and then offered the freedom of opportunity to take those advantages and to make of them what they will. We can study billionaires as an exemplars of human nature, but not study them from a condemnation point of view. We can recall the words of the light on the path, to work as he who is ambitious. We can work as hard, but with the motive to fulfill duty, to be ethical in how we earn money, to be ethical on how we use money. And we can choose. We can't have many masters. We might have to choose between professional ambitions and the ambition that's been lifted to the point of philanthropy. We get to choose that master. We get to choose and use that master, and we can use it well. In The Key, we read from Blavatsky that it's necessary to sacrifice oneself, one life, to benefit many. And in that way, we can recall scholarship winners who have come from the quote rags status, have moved through on scholarships, have become self-fulfilled, self-actualizing adults in their service to humanity. They've taken their roots and their riches become the bloom of all. So power, we've got it. We've got it amply right now. The Kali Yuga, in this incarnation, we have Kama principle, the desire principle, probably overarching most of our use of mind and heart. But we can grow an understanding of right living within karma, and we can follow what the committee set up for us this past set of Sundays. What are those universal powers? How do we understand them? How do we use our imagination and motive-making process in order to raise our concepts of those spiritual powers? How can we see partial genius, full genius, from a logical point of view, an intuitive point of view, and hold a life's meditation that reflects the fact that genius is in our nature as soul, and that it is equal in every single human being on the planet? How can we create the spiritual life? Creating thought, using will and aspiration, the highest of desires, but bringing it not from the theoretical book learning, but rather into action in daily life, moment by moment. And ultimately, how can we monitor and adjust using a lifetime's meditation? How can we develop the habit, the automaticity of being in the moment, being present, doing our duty in the moment, and still being able to be a witness on the scene, to monitor and adjust, and to uplift as best we can, blending psychic and spiritual powers, blending the highest concept of ambition into the loftiest construct of aspiring and aspiring well. So that's one student's consideration on the theme. I'm sure you came this morning to the gathering with your own considerations on the theme. Don't be shy. Oh, there's a hand. SL.
So in the context of our theme of psychism and spirituality, we wonder if ambition is the psychic, that which moves from without within, because in ambition, we're always trying to acquire something outside for ourselves. Whereas aspiration is the spiritual or the noetic, it's the moving from within outward. It's some ideal that we perceive within that we try to manifest outwardly, first in ourselves and then in society. So maybe we could look at the two that way.
And that's really a key point, because in terms of children, if we think about children as they grow, as caregivers, we have to be very cautious, because frequently school districts are set up to produce really fine workers for the economic system. And in recent years, last several decades, the experiment with middle schoolers has been that everybody is okay. Any achievement, any degree of achievement is okay. And everybody gets the same rewards. Everybody gets exactly the same trophies. It goes on in little ball game fields. And that begins to hearken to this higher inner dream or ideal that, yes, from the inside out, a child has to know his or her value and worth as a human being. But that has to come from within, from the heart, from the soul. It cannot be something that's personal, that's being rewarded by the outer society in a manner that is crippling. Yes, very, very poignant. Ambition can be trained from without by parents, teachers, caregivers, thought leaders. And aspirations can be encouraged from within if we take a moment to encourage the child and any other to begin to reflect from within. We're soul. What makes sense? What seems familiar? What seems valuable and uplifting? Theosophy Hall and then MHW.
Well, our thought here is, if ambition and aspiration are along this, we think the speaker said, along this continuum, which is desire, this different aspects. It's interesting that in that little devotional book, The Voice of the Silence, it tells us to kill out desire.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also told that when the human being transitions, when we die, we move into this state of bliss and bring with us our highest thoughts and aspirations. So is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Should we have killed everything out? Can we get a distinction? What's going on?
So that amazing phrase, kill out desire, is in support of what we read in The Light of the Path today. Desire is, the karmic nature of desire is a force that's universal, and it is part of the entire process of development and natural life as soul in a physical condition. It just is. We have to be aware of it. So what we're killing out are those arbitrary, reactionary, stimuli from sensations from the external. We're killing out the attachment of past impress, of selfish living, of living in the moment because there is no future. You know, all that illogical thinking of this is one life only, and after this, that's the end. And as we begin to kill out those manifestations of desire, we simultaneously are working on building up the internal intuitive notions of desire as aspiring for one and all. And what are we told about the after-death states? That we have so much force built up at the time of the break between soul and the physical terrestrial expression, that all that force of desire needs to dissipate in the after-death states. The lowest ambitions, self-centered, selfish desires, passion, lower passions and desires are dissipated in what's called the Kamalokic state. The very cream of the crop, the highest aspirations of kind-hearted thinking for others, of love and compassion and altruism, those passions and desires are also lived out in the Devakonic state, the heaven state, and at the same time are refined, refined, refined in that effect state and become part of the highest nature of soul and go with us into future incarnations. So, which way are we going to turn? Which wolf are we going to feed? Are we going to feed the personal or are we going to feed the universal? MHW.
Yes, we looked up in the dictionary. There's a dictionary where you can compare two things, and when I put in ambition and aspiration, ambition came up as being a more external type of expression. Says ambition is about achieving and is goal-oriented, whereas aspiration is about becoming and it's identity-oriented. But we're wondering about can ambition, excuse us, can aspiration, if one is looking, if it's an internal type of thought, to become, then wouldn't it also be an ambition because it's something that we want to achieve?
Well, that depends on motive, doesn't it? And it depends on how soul is using mind. Is the soul using logic from the premise of, I have an aspiration because this personality wants to be good in the eyes of all humans? Kind of a negative goodness. It might be an aspiration that's rising from within, but it's tinged with selfishness. And aren't we alerted to the fact that right through all stages of incarnations until the very last, we have to guard against spiritual pride and spiritual vanity? So, yes, that's possible. And therefore, it's all the more important that we root out our thinking and our responses and try to determine what the motive is. Stephen, we'll get to you in a minute. We've got a couple of, well, we've got one comment. Might the two volitions be compared to the difference between centripetal force and centrifugal force on a cosmic level? I feel like that scales to the microcosmic, to human life. And again, there's the notion of, is the energy something that is centered back toward a center from the outside in, or is it something that is generated from the inside out? balance and force. And again, the key is the nature of motive. How often have we thought we had the best motive in helping some other, only to find out decades later that whatever we did was actually a hindrance in their self-conscious development and was actually more about what we wanted to achieve for them instead of what they needed. Stephen, you first, and then MDW, and then SL.
Okay. Yeah, this is a response and a reaction to the difficulty, really, of the very beginning of light on the path, because we're told that we mustn't be able, our speech must be helpful rather than condemning. And more importantly, I think regarding hearing, must give up its sensitivity. And from the point of view of new students, for instance, who come and hear what we hear, and perhaps take what we're hearing quite personally to begin with. We haven't learned the state of the perceiver. We haven't got much space between what we hear and what we think. And but on the other hand, the notion of hearing and sensitivity strikes me as the motive behind Pythagoreans saying that there should be quiet in the student for some years. Because what we're hearing needs to be dealt with before we can speak. Yeah. So, yeah, it strikes me that we're constantly juggling ourselves until it becomes a definite state of the perceiver. That we're fighting a little bit of Kukshetra pretty constantly when we listen to good meetings, as this one has been, where the interior and the exterior have been expressed in terms of. Strong idealisms and that kind of thing. But the notion of sensitivity and hearing struck me as a very powerful note.
It's extremely powerful, and Pythagoras is one example of the mystery schools and the monastic use of silence, take in information, listen. How often in childhood or even recently have been we advised to hold our tongues and to count to 10 and to listen to try to learn what the circumstance is and then how it would be wise to work with it. Light on the Path goes on. I think it's rules 9 and 10, maybe even 11 and 12, where we're advised to desire only that which is within us. Desire only that which is beyond you, and desire only that which is unattainable. References that are tough to work with, because we're constantly trying to break out of the bondage, the limitations of the physical incarnation, turn away from that, turn within, and try to find the meaning within for each of us. It's a research process. I think MDW was next, and then SL.
Yes, listening to our conversation this morning, it seems basically we're talking about the head doctrine and the heart doctrine. Ambition, as was said, is from the external, aspiration is from the heart. So if we look at it that way, we see that throughout the philosophy of how it can be applied.
Excellent point. Excellent point. And what came to mind during that comment was a recent example, mundane, but a good one. Rick Steves, who has developed this remarkable, personally fulfilling, incredibly hedonistic lifestyle of traveling, but that's become his career. He took a hippie backpack and turned it into a megabuck career of touring Europe and touring here and touring there and developing films for PPS and elsewhere. He recently, very quietly, and it took months for this to come to light, turns out he's been using his millions of dollars to establish schools and human services for many other people in his local locale. And very quietly, no fanfare, he transmuted personal ambition for fun and games into this incredibly successful career. Quantitative from the lower aspects of desire is quite lofty, but now is transmuting all those decades of ambition and fulfillment into something that's quite universal. And his point was, there's a limit to anything that any one of us really needs. There's unlimited need among others, and we're to fulfill that. Nice case example. SL?
Going back to that thought-provoking chat on comparing centripetal and centrifugal force with the psychic and the noetic, or ambition and aspiration, that idea of centripetal and centrifugal force, both are necessary.
Yes.
The universe, nothing could exist unless there was a balance. So that seems to mean that ambition can't be completely ruled out. Nor can our aspiration be unchecked. That, in a sense, we have to have a healthy ambition and yet an aspiration which is grounded, or at least with a purpose that includes all, not just ourselves.
The point that we come into this incarnation, our dharma, certainly as self-fulfilling soul, is to be reflective and to be creative and to be self-evolving in service to all humanity and beyond, all classes of nature. And the tools, the manifestations of this dharma, this force, that can be psychic and noetic, depending on the need during any moment. This force is like light and dark, being the eternal ways. That abstract, absolute sense of motion that we use as an analogy for the abstract is also ongoing because that motion of desire arises in all forms of manifestation. And it's only in the human state that soul can self-identify what those necessary forces are. What are the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas? How can we rise above them to use them in order to benefit the all? They're natural impulses, they're natural forces. Yes, we've colored them in our past lives karmically. They're going to come back again to haunt us or give us an opportunity, depending on our point of view. But how can we use them and use them in fine service? The power for each of us is in the pause. When we pause and we consider, we reflect. We make the effort to try to understand our companions in life and act for the namaste bridge between us or among us. The power is in that pause. And where are we in that pause? Are we in cold logic using a premise to conclusion? Are we lifting that process into the heart doctrine, away from the head doctrine? Into a process that is more spiritual, but the two are complementary. One does not exist without the other. If we didn't have the contrasts, how would we envision what is better best? How would we discern what is a necessity versus what is a desire or a want? And how could we serve our family of origin, our family of chosen friends, our ULT family? How could we serve the family of strangers that are also our brothers and sisters? How could we do that unless we had some contrast in which finite mind could begin to understand, grow in wisdom, and eventually bloom in intuition and full soul powers? It's all needed. It's just, are we up to the process of recognizing it and using it? We have time for another question, comment, observation. Theosophy Hall? Oh, no? Okay. No? Okay, there is a really short reading from the Dhammapada. And this tiny little book was inherited. It's far older than I am. It's one of the original publications from ULT Mumbai. And it's an interesting little book in that the Sanskrit and the English appear side by side. And I'm referring to Roman numeral 16, the Canto of the Pleasant. He who gives himself solely to sensual pleasures, which are unbefitting, and does not devote himself to the pursuit of higher knowledge, thereby abandons his own good by grasping at what is pleasant to him, and envies him who has devoted himself to the pursuit of higher knowledge. So at all times, we are in a soulful process of blooming, but let it be that we are blooming on behalf of the all, not from a personality, not from the psychic applications, but from something far more encompassing. Our time is up. Thanks for attending, and we'll see you Wednesday night.